I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I reside in Salem at 1323 Jordan Drive South. I am here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 905, the bill that a number of school districts have asked to be introduced, and we have talked to Senator Corey and Senator the House to correct the problem that was created by the enactment of the Uniform Controlled Substance Act in 1978. Excuse me, to effect July 1, 1978. Our problem is that I don't believe that any school personnel can now administer any types of medication. The problem is highlighted very well in the memo that I just handed out to you, and I'd like to draw it to your attention. The second paragraph, it's a memo that was sent to all schools by the Department of Education. The second paragraph notes that it's a crime for any teacher, nurse, or administrator to administer medication. The bottom paragraph notes that the Board of Pharmacy doesn't feel that it was the intent of legislation to make it difficult or impractical for schools to control the drugs brought to school by kids and prescribed by doctors, and where the parent has made a written request that the school parts out the medicine to the child. The memo goes on to say that you should adopt a policy related to this issue, but you shouldn't adopt a policy that is contrary to law. So in fact, it is contrary to law. And then they set out what would be in a good policy. The language that's before you in 905 is language that essentially places both recommendations in the statute. It safeguards the person that's receiving medication, and that the only medication we're talking about is prescribed medication. That will be given pursuant to a note from the parent in accordance with the prescription. And we are asking that this be enacted to clarify that this kind of medication can be administered at school. There are two kinds of problems. One are the kids who are allergic to insect bites, who are known to be allergic and have a very short period of time after a bite in which they must receive medication. These youngsters have prescribed medicine usually with them, and it needs to be administered. Quite often, in the case of an insect bite, they may not be able to administer themselves. The other is the increasing number of handicapped youngsters that we have in the school. Many of them take medication related to their handicap, and they cannot wait. Much of it is on 3 or 4 hours frequency, and we, according to state and school, they must have this medication. And if we cannot administer it or store it at school and let it be administered, it creates a problem for those youngsters. There's no opposition to the bill, I believe there's none. Volunteers in the RMA, we've been involved with the nurses, the pharmaceutical board, and all parties support the intent and the language submitted here.
Yeah, you're throwing an extra little tidbit in the bill, and that has to do with the exception from negligence, exception of liability for negligence. How about if we delete the word gross on line 82? We took the whole civil damage thing out. What you're really looking at here is the problem of criminal liability.
Yeah.
Knowing that you're criminally liable for doing, I got no problem with that. I do have problem with exempting people from civil liability.
On the question of the administration of epinephrine for two children that had 30-second reaction times to these things. You possibly could be, if you're talking about the administration of medication in a truly emergent situation like the 20-second reaction time and the life of that. But the other problem, if the child needs a tablet at 10 o'clock and at 2 o'clock, and it's in a prescription bottle, and the doctor is given a prescription, and the parents request the school to make sure that the child takes it at those times. In that situation, I don't think the good school is that would apply, and it would run counter to the Controlled Substances Act.
Okay, I understand that. And I think in those cases, I think a teacher ought to be pretty careful if they're giving out at 2 o'clock and not before lunch. You know, I think if they're doing it, then.
Well, I think the standards that the school people will develop. If this became law, it's got a full written permission of the parent and any kind of special instruction. I think we would encourage them to make sure that the prescription itself on the container is totally clear about what the time is, the dosage amount, things like that.
I think the important, if we were to take out the word dose, I think it's a good idea. But the importance is, number one, there would be no vicarious liability on the part, I think that might be the appropriate term, on the part of the school employee, which might result from the negligence of the prescribing physician or whoever. And so probably part of what I'm saying is, in a sense, for the record, for the meaning that we're facing on this, that we're looking at this like we are in the case of a disclosed agent who's saying that the fact that the teacher or a school employee follows the instructions given to him and her via the prescription of parents, that will serve as a shield against liability for them, unless in fact they are guilty of some negligence over, above, and beyond whatever negligence might have been involved by the physician or parents or whatever. And that's just a good deal.
That's how we're asking. The language is there, that's the way the mission might have written, and we use that language. Things like that we might go on this could have to outline of an appropriate policy is on page 2 of this, and it talks about you would designate one person in the building as being responsible if you happen to be here at 10 and at 2 as you're supposed to. And,
okay. I would move that we remove the word gross on line 8 so that you would show it would be ordinary negligence or willful and wanton misconduct. Is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none. I just talked to them. Steve brought it up. You have no objection to ordinary negligence in this study. They don't. It's so amended. It's kind of rising there. He was here a minute ago.
Can't you
read that in the hall? Let's see if it's out in the hall. If we get another finger here, it'd be nice. It's fairly simple. In concept, and I point it out. Well, we'll hold it till we get another senator here. Let's go. Oh, Senator Lyle?
Well, it really, like to send out here, it seems quite simple. And we just remembered the Senate Bill 905. We remembered that by taking out the word growth. So that what it does is to say that where a physician or a parent has provided a prescription that a school employee may carry out the administration of the medicine without being personally liable for doing what the physician or parent asked them to do. It's apparently a problem that was created last session with the Uniform Controlled Substances Act. So I move that the bill be sent to the floor and do pass as amended. So the clerk will call the roll.
Anything doesn't apply to a teacher or a nurse giving permission in writing from the parent giving them the controlled substance to the kid. So that if I want my daughter to stay in school, I say two quaaludes at lunch in writing, and the nurse can do that.
What's the doctor's prescription?
Doesn't seem to me like there's any reason why the nurse shouldn't be able to if there's a guy in the candy store again.
Are you going back somewhere?
Yeah, I'm just going
on. Okay. Let's go to House Bill 2011. Yes, if you do that, you do it, that's
okay. I don't
want to
let you off,
right? I don't want to let you off, right? I'm going to
let you off, right? Okay, Mr. Porter, tell us about this bill.
Chairman of the Committee, House Bill 2011 was introduced by the Interim Committee on the Judiciary at my request to simplify use of certain C-5 type records for longitudinal research. Longitudinal research in individuals, genealogical research. Many of the studies that now have become respectable and I believe are increasingly needed. One of the problems that has happened with the Open Records Act of 1972 and 192-500, access to a great many records is actually decreased by some of the rather broad general language that permits access to records on a reasonable basis. And I would simply like to set a time span on that so the custodians of records won't be constantly faced with this problem of determining or even permitted to determine whether access is reasonable or not. As in most cases, it is unreasonable to be still denying access after 75 years to personal information about a person, and yet some records custodians have in fact been doing just that. Adoption records, for example, were not restricted at all in access prior to 1939. In fact, prior to 1913, after 1913, a judge could, or his own option, restrict access to adoptions, but he had many counties for refusing access to entries in the open general information because adoption records, for example, weren't restricted prior to 1939. And unfortunately, birth certificates, vital statistics records, were not established universally across this nation until as late as 1927. In Oregon, the universal reporting of vital statistics started about 1913, and about two-thirds of the states did. But in some cases, these older case files are really essential on genealogical research, extremely valuable on genetic research, and are very valuable, of course, in tracing the benefits of public acts. acts made in question in changing our penal system over the years. It appears to me that it might be valuable for the legislature to be able to see studies now made to indicate what has been the result of that by studying some of these case files over a long period of time. Psychological case files serve much the same purpose in evaluating medical treatment. And in addition to that, the case files of people in the state institution, such as the state hospital, are quite revealing and a little unusual information is in them. Prior to World War II, a fairly large percentage of people in county homes and in the state hospital were there for conditions that I believe can be recognized now as being simple senility. Arterial sclerosis, the old age affliction, that prior to 1942 was often resulted in institutionalization. These days, of course, would not. And I believe that the way more ready access to things such as the Great Register of the State Hospital. If I really applied the current language of 192.500 religiously, then a record, a whole series of records, these registers of the hospital, county farms, and that sort of thing, that had historically been open for access, we would have to deny access to, because they give to the name of the person, their address, their parentage, the diagnosis, their ability. Now, the Corrections Division, in fact, the members for the House Committee, had some reservations to the original bill, and the original bill was worked over by the House Committee, partly to respond to the Corrections Division's reservations. And this morning, in talking with Mr. Chambers of the Corrections Division, it occurred to me that I see no earthly reason in the world why restriction of access to those records for 25 years after release would inhibit their use for research. And it would make corrections feel a little bit more secure with this bill if subsection 3 of section 3 of A.M. Goff's House Bill 2011 was amended in line 15 after the word person in verse who has been, and in line 16 after the word government in verse shall be exempt for disclosure for 25 years after termination of such custody, and delete the word in at the end of the line, then in line 17 delete the word custody.
So it would read how?
So it would read records of a person who has been in the custody or under the lawful supervision of a state agency, a court, or a unit of local government shall be exempt for disclosure for 25 years after termination of such custody to the extent that disclosure thereof would interfere with the rehabilitation of the person in custody if the public interest in question of the person, if the public interest in confidentiality clearly outweighs the public interest in disclosure. In other words, we have preserved the language that's currently in 192.500 pertaining to records of individuals in custody, and simply added to that the 25-year period in which the test of reasonableness is going to have to be applied pretty religiously by any custodian. Now, what I would like to avoid is having records custodians, such as members of my own staff, county clerk, making this reasonable determination. So long as the records are still at the institution, the professional corrections officers, the superintendents have no problem determining reasonableness. But I really do not believe that records custodians should be granted the current authority that 192.500 gives them to just arbitrarily say that's not reasonable. And after 25 years after a person is discharged, the test of reasonableness drops off a little bit.
Kevin?
Yeah.
Is there any requirements about what happens this information after a research is gathered? Is it then totally public so they can use it for whatever purpose they want, or they either confidentiality the plan of Dr. Rector?
It is my hope that with this bill we would set a time period after which no additional restrictions or follow-up would be necessary. That's why we have proposed the 75 years in general during the lifespan of an individual, the right to privacy.
Well, I mean, 25 years from here, the person was in jail when they were 21. 25 years later, they're still alive in middle age. And when somebody gets this record, and all of a sudden that's not what they chose to publicize, okay, it could be a private system. Yeah, I assume what you want to do is for research and not for
Yes.
Right?
Yes. For general research. There's been no problem in getting researchers that really not to book names. It is, in fact, a common practice. And not to specify names. And, of course, the researcher who does cite names and cite specific personal data does run the risk of a libel suit for malicious use of the information.
Okay.
I was just trying to see that under the present law, if someone is incarcerated, what is the restriction on the release of that information now?
At present, the restriction is not as great as it would be under the amendment I've just read. At present, the restriction is only a reasonable access so long as it would not interfere with rehabilitation of the person in custody. And this is the question that has, in fact, been raised by correction and the state hospital both, that the present law really does not give them much way to restrict access the second a person is released from custody, other than to go back to the earlier section, subsection 2, I believe it is, under the 92500 sub 2, relating to personal information. They have a little weaker read to rely on the moment a person is released from custody than they have during the time they are in custody. And of course, rehabilitation may well proceed during the next 25 year interval after the release from actual custody. So, this 25 years is really an added protection. And from my viewpoint, as state archivist, I do not feel that it is an inhibitory at all to add this protection for them.
Notwithstanding that, and except that are public records that are more than 25 years old shall be available for inspection. The following public records are exempt from disclosure, and it's the records of a person who was in custody or
yes, he has
been. So the release from custody, how do you
do it? Has been in custody, would be the first in line 15, and then in line 16, the language shall be exempt for disclosure, from disclosure for 25 years after termination of such custody, except to the extent that it would not interfere. So that's the test of reasonableness.
So you're putting the burden upon those who would release the information.
Yes.
Rather than the burden, in a sense, being on the someone who has the concern for the individual.
And that burden is totally imposed under 192.500, the test of reasonableness again. And that is really my reason for taking it to the committee, that that test of reasonableness puts the burden on the record custodian, the one who actually has the records in their custody. And it's all too easy for a reference archivist or a county clerk to be efficient. And to just arbitrarily say, you can't see that, and the law doesn't say, I have to show it to you. So I'm not going to show it to you. I don't consider it reasonable.
Is there anyone here from the Corrections Division.
Yeah, but if you don't coming up, how long has this been the law, and how have you treated this under the existing law? Do you mind giving me your name? And
you are Jim Lucas, Executive Assistant Corrections Division. The change to the presentation of 192.500 was in 1975, I think, or 1977. Our handling of it essentially has been one of setting forth a listing of items that we feel are openly public items, and making available to the individual concerned any records for which we could not make a clear case that disclosure that hazarded that individual himself or some other individual. Other persons are considered on a case-by-case basis depending on what they are and who they are. In terms of, on the one hand, trying to balance the privacy, the right of privacy of the individual and his treatment needs, and on the other, the public right to information that has been done on an individual case basis. You see, we've had virtually no difficulty. The reason that we were concerned when we saw this particular bill was that it looked to us as though the moment the individual was finally terminated from supervision, that would automatically make that person's records openly available to anyone that wanted to ask if that person was terminated from supervision after a period of 25 years or more. And that, of course, is the very kind of case that would be most likely to have people standing at the door ready to get out there. We didn't think that was fair for the individual privacy right of the individual concerned, and certainly could prove debilitating to the individual in trying to make a readjustment into the general community following such an extended length of time to have anything that's known about that individual available to the general public.
What do you think about the shifting of the burden, so to speak, that the amendment to the existing law as suggested by Mr. Porter? What do you think the effect of that would be?
Well, the existing 192.500 requires us to demonstrate that information should not be released, so that there is a public interest in confidentiality. So really, that would be no essential change. It would simply be an extension which would make possible the thing that the Porter wants, and at the same time guarantee some degree of reasonable privacy to corrections and mental health reason clients.
I think we need to make sure that the language, let's see, number one, retains that the Corrections Division has the right basically any time to restrict the release of some information. Now that's what you want, that's what you have now, and that's what you want to continue to do, isn't it? I'm not sure what the effect of the bill or of the amendment really would be.
Frankly, from our point of view, Senator, we would find it easier at any time if the burden of proof were on the requester rather than on us. But we're quite willing to continue to live with the situation as it is.
Right now, the burden is on you?
Right now, to restrict information, we would, of necessity, have to demonstrate that the information would fall within the provisions of confidentiality under 192.500A-5A-D, I think it is. And yes?
Sub 2A-D, right.
However, the As I say, we haven't had a lot of difficulty with it. We've been taken to court, I believe, twice. And in both cases, the issue was resolved in our favor after we demonstrated to the judge our reason for our judgment.
Any further questions?
Well, look, one of the children, I think that's one. You can have a dress code for staff.
Are you referring to my outfit on the floor? Or anyone who is getting married prospectively doesn't want to. How long are prospectively prospect.
Nothing more risky than bikinis.
So, maybe it's a liberal contractor, but it's a
a summer comes nearer. Thank you, and I graduate to a bolo in the first day of sunshine. You really want to mention something just on the specialist of the House side. The House is a member. In fact, you're getting one of the bills on adoption records as well. But the House committee had about 3 bills on adoption records, and they deliberately heard this bill first and elected this as being the alternative way on the adoption record to solve that whole problem. 75 years having been a huge step by the Congress of the United States on access to censorship, which became
that is
on
that
line.
Yep. What do we say?
On adoption records, the first one is 109,400.
Two.
You got it?
109,400?
Yep. And the other one, look up.
Is there anyone else here on that bill? Is there? 2011? Okay. So if anyone wants to testify on any of these bills, be sure to sign up, because I'll just go through and call in any of those who've signed up. And if you haven't signed up, I'm not going to go around and sign up. Okay, House Bill 2012. And here we have nobody.
That's going to be me then, Mr. Chairman. I drafted this bill during the interim. It was part of the Interim Judiciary Committee Juvenile Law Subcommittee recommendation to the legislature. The effect of this bill is to codify in statute holding on double jeopardy. There is no statute in our current law barring duplicate proceedings against the juvenile, even though we have the Supreme Court case law saying that the prohibitions against double jeopardy apply equally to juveniles. The current practice around the state, because there is no statute that prohibits trying a juvenile twice for the same offense, the practice is, if they don't get a favorable ruling, if the state does not get a favorable ruling the first time, they appeal it up to the circuit court and they get a whole new trial against the child. And still that's contrary to the Supreme Court law in the area. And this will add a new section to Chapter 419 of the Juvenile Code to say that once a child has gone to formal adjudication, once jeopardy has attached, the child shall not be tried a second time for the same offense.
Is there an appeal de novo to the circuit court?
Oh, yes.
From juvenile court?
That's right. What is it?
By either party?
The child's been found innocent after having gone to adjudication.
Are you saying that following an adjudication in a juvenile court, that the state, even though there'll be an acquittal or not, they have the right of a de novo?
That's right. The child is tried entirely a second time for the same offense after having been acquitted after adjudication. That's the word that's equivalent to trial.
Jeopardy is not here by the repeated evidence on the older issue.
Not only has jeopardy passed just by calling the first witness, but jeopardy is fully passed since the child is gone all the way through the adjudicatory hearing and it's been found not, well, I'll use the phrase not guilty, but the phrase is not within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court.
Is there a constitutional law on that point?
Oh, yes.
And then who is it? There's no jeopardy. There's no former jeopardy because of the difference
between the two. No, in fact, the constitutional law holds that ordinary double jeopardy principles apply equally to juvenile.
Same form,
but because we have no statute on juvenile law, this is being done around the state. I was surprised to hear that the defense attorneys in the state are not challenging the de novo appeal on the grounds of former jeopardy. Maybe because they feel because it was in the juvenile court first that jeopardy didn't attach, but I think that that's not legitimate.
Any further questions? Okay, let's go to the next step. 2067. The chamber.
467. Requested introduction of House Bill 2067, basically for two reasons. First and most important, we are not aware of any statute which currently specifies that persons who are granted probation may be housed in any state residential facility other than a penitentiary tourist camp. A few judges have indicated that they are willing to consider the statute to permit such housing if it is appropriate to probationers, several others have indicated that they do not believe that that would be lawful. The bill was intended to clarify that as an option in conjunction with the Community Corrections Act to provide an additional option to the court in its decision as to what to do with offenders. Simultaneously, a second but less important reason is that currently statutes refer in some places to community centers and in other community correction centers and in other locations to youth relief centers. We thought as long as we were addressing the issue, we might standardize that language to avoid any confusion.
Yes. Are you saying that simply because the statute does not say that as a condition of probation that the defendant or probationer may be required to live in a community correction center, the judge declines to include that in his
probation? We have been heard informally by some judges that they question whether or not, in face of challenge, they could make such a requirement. And the judges do see this, by and large, as a viable option. And they'd like to be able to. They'd like to construe it that way. But this would qualify legislative intent.
One kneels down.
Yes.
Here's the language. This is old friend now that is heading before you, but it says may include, as well as any others, these conditions.
You see, we haven't heard of that, Senator Ace, that they're not positive that the correction division has the authority to accept such person into such housing if it's state owned or state operated.
So,
and this would clarify that also.
The judges are doubting, and the correction division.
We're not sure either. And this would clarify and not only allow but require the corrections division to go through the administrative procedures process and develop rules by which the whole thing would work and make sure that all bases are covered and everybody is well protected.
If we're in that deal, we ought to go through and take out the game of the movie.
Steve, I missed that one.
Here's
some
human behavior.
Oh.
Permit the probation officer to be returned to the place of the board of the officer. For example, what gives the permit?
Seven three.
Judgment as to what would be proper staffing.
Can I clarify the section 6 is a new language which is going to apply just to lockups as opposed to local correctional facilities?
Yes.
And we're setting out two different types of standards, two different types of facilities here, standards now.
Actually, three different types. We have also added the temporary hold for those very small facilities that are in the very large central agency only.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, I'm trying to find out what additional restrictions or other changes you would put in that place in section 6.
Okay.
We covered subsection 1 now. There's two. Additional language, new language?
No, there's not.
Three?
No.
Four?
Four specifies more regularly. I think the old language stated that they have three meals a day. And this sets forth a more of a set of time.
Okay.
Five has some wording change that essentially the same thing. We found out some legal opinion that we were talking about in and out mail, and what we're really interested in is that mail which comes in, not what goes out. Actually, the only wording change there used to say the international code of conference the traders now is in compliance with the state structural and building code. No, 6 is the same.
Okay, go on.
Number 9 would be an addition. Ensure the facility be clean, provide bedding that is clean and fire retardant.
You guys continue to provide mattresses and blankets that are clean.
Yeah. They did not want to get into the sheets, the sanitize or the fire retardant of sheets and pillowcases and that type of thing. So that was amended in the house.
And
10 provides emergency medical and dental health, having written policies providing for a licensed physician to review the facility's medical and dental plan. That is new.
Why the physician reviewing the dental plan?
That was a question that was raised in the house, we did at one time have a dentist reviewing the dentist plan that was deleted out, getting notes that it was not a significant enough program in most cases to require a dentist to come in and do a plan. That was the major feeling.
Now, just doing something else for a moment there. You mentioned on page 3 about the word and dentist being, you thought it had been deleted.
Yeah.
Diana, I think we ought to check the original version of the House bill and see if in fact it was deleted, but just not printed. And if it was deleted, then we don't need to amend it. Otherwise, I suppose we can't.
It looks as though they've taken it out in section 10 on page 4, line 10, but did not take it out in page 3, line 1, for the first name center.
Okay. Yeah. I guess, let me just cut through all the questions, or I didn't get out my concern. How many jails are we going to close in the state of the past bill?
Probably none.
What about temporary holds?
Temporary holds, we will not close any temporary holds, but we legitimize the temporary holds, which are kind of get out at the moment. And it probably will help some of those people who are not meeting larger standards become a temporary hold. I actually got a call from the city of Richmond just this morning in that regard.
What's your Medicare situation
right now? They have myself back in the budget, I understand, but no secretary or nobody else.
Are you going to have any funds to
address
the
inspection? I don't know. The way the grass situation is right now, the restrictions there can't get out of town. I just walk down here. No, I'm not kidding. There is other resources in the division that Mr. Watson can muster, and I think that's not a big scary concern of me, but of the world as a whole. Well, Mr. McAllister called me the other day and said, we're going to wait to ask the session before he talks to the judge again.
I don't think you better do that. I'll talk to you.
You know, that reminds me of a lot. I've read the sign in two different sort of contracts, but
I understand why they want to do that. I understand why they want to do that.
I think it was in 1960 or 60, when he was speaking to people, he talked about certain disasters that occurred in Europe, killing several thousand people, and his comment was, it really was pretty significant as far as the 2,000 or 3,000 that we killed, but as far as the whole world was concerned, it was significant. Okay, thank
you. What did you say to you?
Scott McAllister, the AC's office.
Okay, thank you. Now, we're going to, do you have any questions you want to ask?
I have a little burn, because then we go in there.
Don't want to be part of the field.
You want to go in the field, and then you have to go in.
Yes, I think so. You said that the time period of the closing up from the jail that was utilized from lockups that now may not, that are maybe being used now.
That is a possibility from being around that are used. We have sent out questionnaires and get such comments as well. It's closed. We don't use it except occasionally.
Well, the one in Mitchell, Oregon, I don't think you use it all anymore.
I don't know. We certainly do not inspect it. There are several that came to light after an unfortunate death in a jail that supposedly closed and they were actually running as a temporary lockup.
So is there any problem with finding out if there are lockups now that aren't licensed, and what would make it hard to find that out?
Well, it's in the past, people have those that have been closed and actually use it occasionally, you know, to throw somebody in or hold somebody until they get their wages for transportation effort.
Well, how is it going to make it easier for them to use those legally now? If we pass this bill, what about this bill will make that easier and make that permissible?
Well, I think that they feel that they cannot meet all the standards that are currently in the jail standards. There's only one definition, either in the jail business or out. There's no in between type of thing. The 10-mandatory standards apply to what you do as well as they do the lockup, say, in Mitchell or Unitella. And this is one of the inequities and one of the reasons we wanted to make those three categories of jails for the two various kinds of operations that are going on in Oregon.
Further questions?
Well, yes.
I guess I'm pursuing a work session. It's probably the same thing as sort of the people who might get thrown in on one of the places being occasionally used. Is it true those 2,000 or 3,000 people? None of which you know have died in Europe. But if this bill is going to make it easier for people to use places that. But I thought the idea was the thing you were moving toward was. Unless something was up to standard, you weren't going to use it, so people would call them the extra distance, even though it wasn't inconvenience and an expense, to prevent things being used that shouldn't be used for people, bad things happen.
That's true, Senator, and may I comment on that? The idea is that it limits the time that they can be held to only 4 hours. So that they do not have to meet the standards of sanitation in the way of food service and that type of thing, food storage. The whole intent is the committee really ranged from 1 hour up to 6 hours, but settled on 4.
Well, how are we knowing when the 4 hours started?
How will we know?
Yeah.
I think
we're going to have to call somebody and say we're putting a person in some central place and say we're putting a person in now, and they start counting 4 hours now, and we can see 8 hours from now. Are we going to be in a situation where we come and find somebody hung themselves along the distance truck that's hung himself, and they say, well, you're going in here 2 hours. How do we know when you're in?
I think most state records reflect the time of booking. Right now, I think all of them do. I don't know of anyone that does not. Knows the time of booking.
And anyway, they said, you have to get back to that meeting pretty soon. Why don't you stay here in case they have some more questions? We dug the gardener out of the conference committee so we could deal with our class action bill. Let's deal with that now, and then we'll have some more questions.
I don't think I will.
Okay. Do you have any more questions?
We'll go to the 904.
Senator Gardner, I have a proposal to amend the bill. I guess prior to that, I have to make the decision to the bill by which the bill is passed out of committee. I make that motion now. Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Chairman, I move that there be an amendment to it. Yes, what I did, Mr. Chairman, was added two provisions on the last page that Senator Gardner suggested today. The provisions are between the after, The court shall make a finding that there is a substantial probability that the plaintiff is prevailing in the merits. That's the First Amendment. Second Amendment is at the very bottom, Section 3. This 1979 Act shall apply to actions commenced after the effective date of this 1979 Act. I've notified proponents and opponents of the substance of these amendments. I see Mr. Kleinman here, and perhaps there are other people in the audience.
I'd like to ask Senator Gardner whether a substantial probability is less than an election agreement and more likely than not.
I think it means 60-70%? No, I don't think it's that high. I think it's over
50%. Does that mean the same thing roughly as more likely than not?
Probably. Then you don't need substantial. You need probably. No, you don't. I want substantial probability. I think that's a good standard. The courts are going to interpret this thing, and it gives them a little bit more of a threshold to meet, I think, before you do the cost. Mr. Chairman, I have no problem with that. You don't think it's enough? No, I don't. The standard is going to be uncertain, I think, in any case, but this will what we had originally discussed as the language for Camlish and I was high probability. I think that would be a little too stiff. I think this is a somewhat amorphous, but it's a little bit more than a probability. I think that's a good safeguard this time. I'd like to stick with that language.
Peppercorn more than one.
About 52%.
Well, the court is going to interpret this. This little discussion we're having here is
very important.
And we're talking about a little more than 6%. So
yeah.
I think that's right. So when you were asked if you thought it meant 60 or 70, you said,
probably not that high, yeah.
We all have a sense of history.
I think we're not going to be able to do it. Area of probability between preponderance and beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, that's the first motion. Is there any objection to that particular amendment?
Section 3 says this 1979 Act shall apply to actions commenced after the effective date of this 1979 Act.
I think as a rule, when a procedural law is changed by the legislature, as long as no due process rights are affected, it does apply to actions that are in process. If the local rules change in Multnomah County, for example, you're having to file a corrected copy of a complaint with your motion to strike, that applies to actions in progress. What I would suggest on this is language that I prepared for Mr. McCandless. I'll read it out. I think it's a way to handle retroactivity that protects the due process rights of the defendant, but avoids some practical problems that I'll point out. The language that I would have would say, this act shall not be applied retroactively to orders entered by any court of this state before the effective date of this act. So that if a court requires the plaintiff to pay notice or requires the claims form, that cannot be changed by the act. But otherwise, a real practical possibility, we always have people coming here with wild hypotheticals of what could happen, but I think this is pretty reasonable. Somebody could file a class action between now and the effective date of this act, but is not going to reach the claim form stage for 5 or 8 years. That's not at all uncommon. And they're going to go dredge up the old law if this amendment passes and apply that to claims forms. Also, the notice stage often isn't reached for a couple of years. And again, they'll have to look back to what existed before the effective date of this act. I really think it's sufficient protection to just avoid any retroactivity where the court has already entered an order.
I think we protest my, as I recall, when the motion was made to take this all together out of those rules of civil procedure, class actions are much more than simple rules of procedure. They, in effect, create, modify substantive rights. And this is a, I think we're making a good liberalization in the law, but I think it's important to make it prospective from, with respect to new actions.
You know, I'm sure the number, you know.
The word liberal. Mr. Chairman, I've been claiming that he hasn't been following the work on the uniform rule of civil procedure that we've been engaging in, that we address this problem of what a procedure rules would be effective when the act passes. We massaged it enough to say that the court is to do justice. And applying the new standard and the old standard. So I am going to make a motion, and I think they've probably got a good position as far as the way to handle it, and clearly delineate if it passes, it takes effect, and if it doesn't, and I think that's a good idea.
Okay.
John?
I agree with Jim and Ted about that it is substantive, but I'd like to have a little more discussion on what substantive law we do want in this area. I think that the language that Jim has proposed has the advantage of even though it doesn't use the word shall not be retroactive or what you said.
Yeah. It started off in one shot.
Yeah, well, and I think if we should eliminate some, it should lessen some of the opposition, and that draws me strongly toward your proposition. But the lengthiness of class action treatment concerns me some about this being a case that has been filed this week, and I don't know, I have one in my mind that maybe, I don't know if it's been filed yet or not. If we pass this bill, that thing might take 10 years to finish up. And this wouldn't affect it. Yeah. That bothers me as a substantive question.
They don't all take that long. The nursing home case took, in fact, there are some practitioners of this art that can get them done fairly promptly. Eldon Rosenthal, Bob Stoll have a good record of getting these things over. It just depends on the kind. There are going to be cases like this which are caught in the pipeline. That's going to be true, I think, of any type of change we make, unless we simply go with a retroactive statute. I think this will increase the likelihood that we'll get this thing passed, and I think it does provide a clear demarcation point, and it also it has the virtue of telling the judge just what actions these new provisions apply to clearly.
How about perhaps as a compromise to that provision, you'd add a section 4, which would have the emergency clause.
That's fine. Yeah.
I'd like to make one comment, Mr. Chairman, if I may. I really think that the language that I propose does address the substantive rights that are involved by not allowing retroactivity where the rights have been decided. And I know that the Senator is concerned with an orderly process and a clear cutoff point, but in a sense, in passing the amendment as drafted, you confuse the cutoff point by the fact that in a few years there'll be certain class actions pending to which this statute will apply and certain class actions to which the old statute will apply. And my intent, if my language works to protect any real substantive rights that exist, I wouldn't argue that it's purely procedural, but I'd say that the due process rights are protected by preserving the existing orders of the court on such matters as cost of notice and the requirement of a claim form. But otherwise, we have some vestigial class action out there with 30,000 class members who are going to have to file a claim form 5 years down the road. I think that my language is sufficient to defeat any arguments on the floor of any abuse of substantive due process and any arguments generally with regards to retroactivity.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's time to. Unless you need more discussion on this.
I would assume
it's a good compromise way to do it.
I would assume that probably the case is that you are, with the one exception, I suppose, that your office is involved in, but with most of the others, it would be possible for you to dismiss and refile, wouldn't it? Without statute having run, you're not right up to your deadline.
No, that would create an interesting legal question. I don't know if that's the kind of approach that we use.
I think the fact, from what I understand, and I did talk to Mr. Carey at one time before this hearing, not before the bill was filed, I don't think, and Mr. Carey and this law firm would like the benefit of this statute
in
its current litigation, and that is, of course, something that would be argued yield some merit by their opponents against the bill, and so that's why
I think it's a
Exactly.
And but I think, in, except for the one case that they've done, they already almost won, which they wouldn't want to dismiss and start all over again. But there was another case that they had filed last week. It's likely that statute will not have run, and they can simply dismiss and start all over again. Because the rules of civil procedure don't go into effect until 90 days after the legislature, and that has some restriction on this system. Okay, so the motion is, Senator Gardner has moved that we add two new sections to the bill, one making this the section 3 as shown on the Senate proposal, and a section 4 which will be border state emergency clause. Okay?
Aye.
Cornell.
Aye.
Smith?
No.
Wire?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Motion carries. Now, Senator,
the one that you had that you wanted to put back in?
I don't think, well, that, I would just assume leave that particular area alone.
Okay.
I would think that.
Okay, Senator Tilly, I can move the bill to the floor, do pass as amended. Clerk will call the roll.
Brown?
Aye.
Slattery?
Aye.
Capori?
Aye.
Hilliard?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Wire?
Aye.
Cook?
Before I vote, I want to make it clear on the, what we've been talking about, that on the points that we are clarifying here, I do not believe we know what the current law is. And so the record should not be taken as, for whatever it may be worth, as indicating that the members of this committee felt this change was necessary in order to permit relative to the claim procedure, I think.
I appreciate your comment, but we have a legislative history, a very precise claim form may not be required, and this is the result intended. Scientific legislative intent that there's a clarification and not.
Clarification of that, right. So this is not intended to say that we think we have to change the law in order to give that right. So I vote aye, and the motion is carried, and Senator Jackson will carry
the right to carry this bill now.
Okay. Now we have another witness or two on the bill we were just on. There's one more bill we were in the law. 2072 again, Robin O'Brien.
For the record, I'm Robin O'Brien representing the Association of Counties, and I am here in support of 2072. While we do have concerns, of course, there is about establishing additional mandates on counties. We feel that case law, existing case law, already requires many of the things that are in this bill. And the bill itself is a product of many efforts and time by a large group of people to come up with a good mix of the existing statutes, case law, and also considering the effect on local government. I do agree with Mr. Bilek that on page 3, line 1 of the bill, the House Committee did delete the requirement for a dentist to review the plan. And let me explain, this doesn't change the requirement that a dentist would have to perform the work. This is merely with respect to the written procedures. It's to review and say, yes, that looks like a reasonable course of action for the facility to take if someone has a toothache. And we do feel that a physician is capable of doing that. And other than that, I think Mr. Bilek has explained the bill, and if there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Any questions? Thank you.
And Senator Smith, I did check with Judge White, and he has no concerns with the bill.
Ted, do you have something you want to say?
Chairman, I forgot to sign up. May I?
Go ahead.
I didn't forget. Yes, I did forget. I was late. My name is
Ted. Good to meet you.
My name is Ted Hughes, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Chief Police, and the Oregon Chief Officers Association. I agree with the previous witness that this is a good bill, a product of many hours of study in the interim. There are still a few questions, I think, in the minds of the sheriffs and the chiefs and the peace officers that should be answered, and I would like to suggest to the committee that section 14 on the last page, we change the effective date from July 1, 1980 to January 1, 1981. Give us 6 more months to get a good audit trail of just what, which of these 90 facilities is going to be in jeopardy because of the bill. That's the only change I would recommend. We support the bill wholeheartedly, because it does deal with the subject that needs updating continually.
Is there any questions? Thank you. All right, I believe we've completed our work. Are we have another witness? Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman, my name is for the record, my name is Lee Penny. Got myself up and giving you a question. The Senate Bill 107, which you hadn't moved before and has now passed the Senate, deals in part with the same subject matter contained in 2073. I have proposed and suggested amendments that would bring these two bills into essential conformance. They're being copied right now, but I'll have them up in just a moment or two. In addition, the government council, working together with the Association of Urban Counties, considered the same proposed standards which form the basis of House Bill 2073. However, the task force amended these slightly to make them more applicable to children, and at that time we weren't aware that 2073 would be introduced, and the task force chose, rather than to introduce a bill, to prepare some proposed administrative rules which are contained in our final report. I'm also suggesting some brief amendments to 2073 that would pick up some of those additions made to the proposed standards that would be specifically applicable to children in these types of institutions. And those are included in my proposed amendments also. If adopted, this would carry out the task force's intention that there should be established some statewide detention standards for juveniles, and would codify them rather than put them in the form of proposed administrative rules.
What would
happen? They were put into our report as proposed administrative rules because of the length and detail of them, and they are essentially what you have in 2073. The task force thought perhaps the administrative rules was the best way to go. With the introduction of 2073, it seemed appropriate to suggest amendments to it that would make it applicable to juveniles as well as adults, and to add those amendments which the task force made to the 2073 materials that would particularly apply to children.
The center did you offer amendment 2073 in the House?
I submitted them to staff and I discussed them with Mr. Bronca, and he thought at that point it would be better to amend 107 when it got over to the House side. 107 went to the House side, and we did have a hearing on it the other day. But again, I conferred with staff this time to Bronca, and we all agreed that 107 wasn't a very good vehicle for it, and that it's more appropriately in this bill. Otherwise, we would have some sort of tail standards and two very widely separated parts of the ORF. It was more a technical decision on amending than it was in the existence of doing it.
Are you going to get to slow your amendment?
I would hope not. Is there another vehicle that you might amend or on the house side? Fairly simple and straightforward bill, as you people amended it here.
Well, it seems that we pulled a lot of people together on this question, and rather than muddy the water again and create controversy over this bill, it might be simpler to try to use 107 as a vehicle, or maybe another bill.
Yeah. Right.
And my only concern was that after you got them together, you got them bust them up.
Right, yeah. I quite agree with it, but I certainly wouldn't want to imperil 2073. The first collection of amendments I proposed here, I do not think would do that, because it would both the first step going down to two-thirds of the way down page 2, simply put this bill in conformance with 107.
Well, and so the point here is that we're going to have to have another hearing.
Because it would add additional requirements in
jail for children in the chapter. We passed 107 in the Senate.
Yes.
We're going to be in the House now.
Yeah, we're hearing in the House tonight. I think we're expecting probably next week.
In the House position?
Mm-hmm.
That's the one in the House that you're talking about. He's going to try to amend 107. He can do it either way.
There is one technical amendment I might want to point out that would be helpful to 107, and that is on page 2 of my amendment, down toward the bottom of the page, the section 5 there. So there are 169.075 is repealed in section 69 of this act and enacted in lieu thereof. That would preserve the cross-reference in Senate Bill 107 to the standards in 169.075. Otherwise, my fear there is that both bills pass 169.075 will simply be dropped out of Senate Bill 107 at some point because it's being repealed by this bill. If we have the enacted in lieu of provision in there, then the cross-references will tie up, and it's just a technical amendment.
Okay, is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much.
That concludes. What do you have now?
Mr. Chairman, good record, Bob O'Brien. If the committee directs you to include these bonus, we would like the opportunity to review them and comment on them before the committee does take action.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so I'm Nancy McCurry representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I wanted just to add to the list of things that I saw had been done in the House by the House Committee after the oversight and drafting on page 3, line 38, and also on page 3, line 9. You'll see will be said daily, and the words in the facility in both of those instances. We had quite a long discussion about what was called the Dahlia Amendment, suggested by Representative Lombard, because in Ashland, the lockup there for years and years and years has taken the prisoners across the street and fed them at the Dahlia restaurant.
We take them to hospital.
Yeah, and this would prohibit us from doing that, and I think would.
I so moved. Okay, unless it's already been done, the motion has been made. Is there any objection? Hearing none, it's so ordered. And you also moved to take out dentists up on line 1 and page 2, didn't you, Senator? Yeah, that was included in the agenda.
I did that.
Okay, and that's what's already taken out. Okay. That's complete. The extension. That's more good.